www.themouthmagazine.com.
My guest on this edition of the Mouthcast is songwriter and frontman for Deacon Blue, a band whose new album is about to give them their highest chart placing for around 20 years. I wouldn't call it a comeback as such, as there's actually been a lot of material in that 20 years. So let's say a resurgence of sorts. So from the resurgent Deacon Blue, Ricky Ross.
Hello.
We'll talk about the new album, amongst other things. We'll hear something from it a little later, but before we talk, let's just go back in time.
Yeah.
1989, and probably Deacon Blue's most recognised hit. This is Real Gone Kid. Ricky, that was Deacon Blue's hit Real Gone Kid, which was from the second album.
Yeah.
We're going to go even further back in time to Glasgow, 1985. You're originally from Dundee, so how did you end up in Glasgow?
I was wanting to be to do some music. Glasgow was more of a centre for doing music, and someone I knew was putting a band together in Glasgow, and I thought, right, if I move, take a job in Glasgow and just kind of reorient myself, and it was basically as simple as that. So I ended up there doing a teaching job because I needed to make some money, and I was sort of playing in the band, on weekends and all that kind of thing, but a different band.
What was the city like back then? It was obviously an industrial working class city, a city of the shipyards, much like Newcastle. I've had the same feeling in both of those cities, actually, that something has gone in some way.
Yeah.
But what was it like back then? Was it as grim as the Raintown album?
See, we don't think of the Raintown album as grim. It's funny. It's other people think that. I think it's, you know, I think it's what it is. But, well, to me, Glasgow was a great place. It was a great, you know, Dundee's smaller, and Glasgow's bigger. So it was more exciting. There was a lot of, you know, I suppose just coming to a bigger place. And I had a few friends there, but I didn't know everyone. So for me, it was just a city where there was lots going on, really. And it always been, in my eyes, you know, the exciting side of Scotland, really. You know, to me, you know, Edinburgh kind of had a month of excitement in the summer.
Right.
But Glasgow had a kind of vibrancy all year round, and lots of writers and artists and musicians came out of the city. So it just seemed like a place that you'd want to go. In the same way as, you know, people gravitate towards Los Angeles or New York or London. In Scotland, you know, Glasgow is a probably natural stopping off point. So a lot of people who were Glasgow bands were actually from Lanarkshire or Ayrshire or other parts, but they, you know, they came in to the city.
So it's the kind of hub, really,
very
of
much
music.
So.
Are you able to recognise the city now? There's obviously been a huge cultural upsurge in the last couple of decades, like Belfast in many ways. It seems to have left its old self behind in some way.
In some ways, I mean, I think a lot of that change had happened before even I got there. I think that was, you know, something that happened in the 50s and 60s more than the 80s, certainly. I mean, by that time, people had, the new towns had been created and so on. And I suppose the things were starting to change. You know, it was by 1988, it was the famous Garden Festival where the BBC now is and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, the city was the city had changed. I'm not sure, you know, I've been living there now more than half my life. So I'm not sure if I would notice the changes, you know, that happened in my time, because you have to leave a place to come back. I mean, I notice it more, all the other notice in Dundee, and Dundee's very much a place on the up, an understanding of that. But Glasgow's up and Dundee's up are quite similar. They're up for certain people, but for other people, life doesn't really change very much. So I think that you've always got to be wary of these things, because the up is the art side, and there's definitely a great deal to be said for that, for just having an economy that's based around, you know, newer industries and creative industries and so on, which Dundee very much is as well. But whether that makes a huge difference to the very deep poverty and unemployment, for example, that some of that's still very much as it was 30 years ago.
I think that's nationwide as well, really, isn't it? You can rebrand yourself New Labour or New Britain. The old things are still there, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, the album Raintown was released in May 1987, so we're coming up to 30 years since then. And there's that really beautiful photo of Glasgow on the front cover. In many ways, that album is a concept album. I've heard it described as a concept album about urban life in the inner city. It's the opening line of the title track is, "It's a rain dirt town, job hurts and it don't pay," which is very Springsteen, I always thought, the way it draws you into that blue-collar character. Did you naturally find that easy to relate to? Because I would say teaching, for instance, is a fairly middle-class profession.
Yeah, I don't think of it as a working-class record, or I don't think of it as an industrial record at all. I think of it as a record about me, and I think it's a, you know, most of them are love songs. It's an odd thing. People probably misunderstand that, but that was my job. You know, it was just the nature of going to work, and the person I was married to at that time, the work that they were doing, you know, it was like, it was work was a, for many people that I knew, was just a bit of a bind, you know, and it was something that kept people kind of down, really, rather than elevated them. So I think the songs were just born out of experience, but there was no attempt for me. I didn't come from a working class background, and there's no songs really, other than Dignity, which is kind of like the odd one out in some ways. There's no, the songs really on that record are really just about aspirations of someone trying to get out of the place in some ways, you know, more than anything else.
I did wonder about that. Did you feel at that time, as we say, you were teaching, did you feel at that time that there was a ceiling, this aspiration to get out of that life? Did you feel that there was no chance, really, of taking it as far as you wanted to take it?
Was
there much opportunity, I think?
I think Glasgow was more of an opportunity than, you know, where I grew up. I grew up in Dundee, and there's no, you know, conception that there was a music industry. You know, that didn't occur to you that you could get a job making music. You know, that wasn't in the... You know, that wasn't in the books of career opportunities. In the way it is, obviously, for kids now, they see that you can do it. And just imagination, your imagination had to take a lot of flights of fancy to sort of get there. So you were just intrigued if anyone ever really got out. So people like the Associates from Dundee and, you know, before that, Average White Band and people like that, you know, they were sort of mythologized. And of course, it was Michael Marra, who was this local folk hero who'd been down to London, made a record in Polydor and come back and so on. So there was all these kind of stories. But by the time I got to Glasgow, I think you knew there was a different story. You know, Glasgow had a different story of people actually, hold on a second, Simple Minds have gone and done this. And you were beginning to hear these stories and think, that's how to do it. So we'll do the same thing.
Because I guess in Glasgow, in the early 80s, there were two scenes, if you like. There was the kind of East Side scene, which Simple Minds would be the kings of, and then there would be the Postcard scene and the bands associated with that. Orange Juice, Lloyd Cole and the Commotions are obviously influenced by Postcard. I actually talked to Lloyd a while ago, and he remembers Glasgow as an extremely vibrant city musically, particularly a bar called Nico's. Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, I mean, there was lots of places, really. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing was, the funny thing was, there wasn't many places to play. I mean, the famous King Tut's didn't appear to the 90s. I mean, one of the reasons that King often we're told with King Tut's was run by our promoters, and because we did quite well, he made quite a lot of money and he bought King Tut's. So, you know, it was one of the things that, but it wasn't there in time for us to play. We played, you know, really behind bars or inappropriate place to play. You know, the worst places to play, because there was not gigs. And sometimes at maybe 1 o'clock in the morning in a nightclub, you'd be on. Although the city had a lot of music going on, there wasn't really the kind of range of venues that there are today. And just wee happenings would take off. But it's funny, you know, lots of things that you would expect to be there in terms of infrastructure just weren't around.
Politically, what was the city like back then? I ask because, I guess, because of Dignity, the song Dignity, there's a very strong thread of, I don't think we'd call it politics, social observation.
Yeah.
Do you remember your own sort of political awakening?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, I think like a lot of people, we were, you know, that was the era, it was the decade of Thatcher's. I mean, she came in 1979, there'd been an election in 83. We were on the road in 87 and forlornly hoping to get a Labour government. Some people in Scotland by that time would have moved off and said, well, we're not going to wait around for that. We're going to go for independence. I was still, and a lot of my friends were still of the opinion, no, let's hope for a Labour government. And I think the following year, 88, there was a famous government by-election. Jim Sillars put out a Labour candidate. And then by the next election, it was kind of like, I think the Labour won that seat back. So it was basically, Scotland was this kind of Labour voting place, but run by Conservatives, you know, that was the deal. So there was a lot of talk about the Scottish Parliament, because that had been something that was going to come in 79 if there'd been a Labour government then. So Scotland's kind of felt like a very forgotten place and a bit of an angry place. You know, I think there was a lot of anger about it, but no one really knew how to channel that, I think. And that was the kind of political situation. I mean, you could ask 10 different people to give you 10 different scenarios. My take on it was that, and that Labour, in a sense, didn't want to... You know, there was an anti-poll tax movement and so on. Labour didn't even want to join in that, because I think they thought that if people started asking these big questions, why weren't they doing more? Why weren't they actually defending people? So it was an angry and sort of disappointed atmosphere. People felt a little bit neglected, I think, really.
I think you can see that again now, can't you? That people have almost, particularly with regards to the Labour Party, lifted up the carpet and they can see what's underneath
it. Yeah, it has, but, you know, you have now completely different sets of possibilities. And, of course, then blame gets tripped around. And it's one of the problems that Scotland's been able to... Different sets of groups of people have been able to use that, you know, to always blame Westminster, you know. And so there is a Scottish government, of course, but there is a good argument to say, well, they don't... they only have their budget set by Westminster. So, you know, these things really are all still in the melting pot. However, it is possible to do some things ourselves now, which I think probably, you know, makes a difference. But, you know, for example, one of the big ones that we were talking about in this record in terms of refugees and asylum seekers, still a Home Office regulated thing, and Scotland as a country can't do anything about changing the laws for people being thrown out or if their asylum claim isn't met. And we've seen people terrified for that. So, you know, it's still a long way to go on these things.
Do you think that there might be another referendum for independence?
Well, there might be, but I think it would be a huge mistake because at the moment, I don't think it would be a mistake eventually, but it's a mistake if you just go back and ask the same question without anything changing. And actually, I think what you would get is people probably consolidating their positions on both sides. I think the yes people would probably consolidate their position. I think that's probably true. But also, I think the no people would say, well, you know, nothing has changed for us. So why would, in a time of complete uncertainty now, when you've got a very, very shaky Conservative government who don't seem to know what they're doing. I mean, they've put up a kind of good kind of bluff, but no one really thinks they know what they're doing. And pull us out of Europe. So you know, when you've got all that uncertainty, anyone would tell you that people are not likely to go for a big wholesale change. So you have to build some considerable new evidence and a new narrative for people to kind of move from one side to the other. So there's no point in people in Scotland getting all hyped up and they're going to marches and stuff like that. I'm saying, well, I don't think that's going to bring people over at the moment. And that's what you need to people to change their mind. And you need to people change their mind without feeling they're threatened or bullied into it. They need to feel that, oh, yeah, this is something we definitely see our life getting better in this way. And we'll have to demonstrate that some kind of way, I think.
www.themouthmagazine.com.
What was the stuff that you heard growing up? What was the music that your parents played around the house?
My parents didn't play much music at all because we didn't have a record player growing up. But eventually we
really?
Got, yeah, we didn't. Well, not when I was a kid. So when we did get a record player, which was maybe midway through primary school, bought a record player. Every record that came in the house got played. My sister got our friend's big brother's, all his Beatles singles, and we just played them all and put them all on the A side and flipped them over on the B side. And the first albums I bought were by the Stones and the Beatles, and my kind of cousin that came and stayed, and she brought Abbey Road in and Jimi Hendrix. The Stones and the Beatles, really, you know, it was all the Stones and the Beatles. And then eventually, you know, I had one big sister, and she, you know, brought the singer-songwriter, the James Taylor and Simon Garfunkel and these kind of things in. So they were the kind of records that I kind of inherited. And the first albums, I bought the Stones and I had the Beatles and so on, but then Elton John came along at Uncle Chateau.
Yeah.
And from there, it sort of led to, I suppose, American West Coast music, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Neil Young especially, and all of that stuff, you know, Jackson Browne, then Springsteen, Randy Newman, all these kind of people, that Joni Mitchell that I kind of really loved. And then so punk came along and that kind of mixed up the things as well. I loved The Clash and The Buzzcocks. And then in the middle of all that, it was Bowie was somewhere as well. So there was all these things going on.
Deacon Blue released an EP of Bacharach and David covers at one point. So I'd guessed that kind of classic songwriting thing had got in there and that the pop and rock thing wasn't necessarily quite as important, that you were perhaps also looking back to show tunes and 50 stuff.
I sort of found myself saying the other day, I don't really write rock music, and I think it's probably true. I don't think really I liked it for its own sake. I liked it when it happened, if people got kind of like rock and roll for its own sake, but I think the idea of, you know, you know, whenever things get close to kind of being rock, rock ethos, rock and, you know, heavy rock or, you know, metal, certainly, I just like, whoa, you know, it has a kind of slightly alienating effect on me, and I never really related to it much. Yeah, my dad told me about Bacharach, and he said, oh, you know, songwriters, he's really important. And so I knew, I always knew the name, and then I kind of got into Dusty Springfield in the 70s as well, and I checked out a lot of her songs, and I knew about Carole King and Jerry Goffin and these people. So I was always interested in, odd enough, like a lot of people that I know, and I'm not the first person to have said this, I just thought it was really cool to have your name in brackets. I mean, I just thought that was the best, to have Lennon, McCartney or Jagger, Richard, you know, whatever it was.
So was the aim for you, the intention,
that
have the name in brackets more than be a performer?
Yeah, I mean, I someone told me you could get a thing called a publishing deal, and I thought that sounded great. I didn't even know what it involved, but I just thought, well, that's a songwriter thing. I want to write songs. And then when I got in the songwriting, ATV Music got really just inside me, eventually signed me. And I said, you know, this is great, but I said, well, who's going to do the songs? They said, well, exactly, you know. I said, who's going to do your songs if you don't? And I wasn't really that determined to do them. I just thought, and oddly enough, my life took a kind of then 25-year, maybe 15-year kind of detour, because then in the last 15 years, I did a lot more songwriting with other people, and but then it's kind of come full circle again, where I thought, I'm a bit tired of that. So you go through different phases, but I essentially wanted to be a songwriter. That was the attraction to me.
So on that note then, performance. There was a great performance film, Deacon Blue. I think it was filmed in Glasgow, actually.
Yeah, it would be the SEC, yeah.
And it was extremely exuberant, let's say, the shows that you put on back in the day. Was that an unnatural state for you, if you like, to perform at that kind of high-octane level?
I think once we'd got into the idea, and then we basically realised that people weren't just going to put our records on the radio, and, you know, we had to go out and work it, we had to go out and play. So from the early days, we kind of got into exploring playing live. We didn't do that much of it before we had a record deal, really, and I hadn't done that much of it. I'd done gigs, but all at a very small level. And so once you got into it and then you realised, gosh, you know, your music, then you're meeting people who are listening to your music and, you know, and they're hearing your record at home and then they're coming to the gig and so on. So once I think we got into it, I think we really got into it. and that's kind of not gone away. Oh, people have an idea that, oh, we couldn't live without it. That's not true. I mean, I think that I always wanted to do things really well, but we never could have been one of these bands that spent, you know, all a year on the road and all that kind of thing. I think we would have gone mad, you know. And it was so I think we just put a intense work ethic into a tour, but I'm not sure that long slog thing would have been right. And I think I would have lost touch with more lost touch more than I did, you know?
Do you feel that you lost touch?
Oh, I think you always do. I think at some point you can. It's very hard. And I was a little bit older when I finished my first record, but I managed to have the friends. I still have the friends now that I had before then, but a lot of them. But it's hard sometimes when you're doing something completely different and you're unreliable. You're away a lot. It's like, oh, I can't, you know.
I can't come to your wedding.
I can't come to things. But you couldn't come at the last minute because plans had changed. So, you know, these things were kind of, I suppose, a strain and a change in your relationship. But we didn't get thrown into the kind of humongously massive pop machine, you know, in a way that maybe other people have. But so we managed to make sense of it all, I think.
I always wondered, the title of the second album, When the World Knows Your Name, seems like fame and success have called and you've escaped from the rain town. And a particular song on that second album is a favourite of mine, and I've always felt that lyrically it might be about fame, and that's Circus Lights. So we'll listen to that now before we talk a little bit more.
Your books touch you all
Circus Lights. Am I right about the lyrics?
Well, it's definitely a song about me, and it was written, oddly enough, that song was written during the Raintown sessions.
Right.
But it was a kind of self-hatred song, you know. I think I looked at, in that 6 months between signing a record deal and then when that song was written, that was written in Ayr Studios, just overlooking Oxford Circus. Mm. And I think it was like, you know, who are you? What do you think you are? You know, it's like that kind of thing. You know, we weren't famous, but by that time, life had changed.
It's
so significantly. We were down in London all the time. We were, suddenly we were doing things that all our pals' bands wanted to be doing and anyone that was a musician. So our life had changed, you know. And I think that maybe there was a bit of me that suddenly thought, I'm not sure. Yeah, I like you anymore.
Bit of guilt, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
The big hits at the time, Real Gone Kid, which we heard at the top of this podcast, is perhaps the one that has most followed you around. Is it difficult going back to songs that, you know, are so well known, or are you kind of grateful for what they gave you?
I'm very grateful, and it was difficult. Not difficult's the wrong word, but it was. Something when you know, maybe mid-90s or early 90s, oh, we're not going to do that, we're not going to do that live. I'm so over that it's not even... And, you know, someone asked me, I think they were expecting a kind of fairly esoteric answer, what's your favourite, you know, song to do live? And I said, Real Gone Kid. You know, one of the reasons is because you look around the room where you're playing and people are very happy. Mm. And they paid them, and that makes them happy. So, you know, it's kind of like a very obvious thing to do, but if you can do that in a good way and create a way and you can bring joy into people's lives, then there's no bad thing about that. So I've kind of got over that. I mean, we don't play every night, we don't play everything, but there's certain songs I think are probably, you know, if Bruce Springsteen can play Born to Run every night, I can play Dignity and Real Gone Kid every night.
Yeah. You mentioned the early 90s there. Mm. Deacon Blue actually broke up in 94. I remember thinking at the time that there was still a long career ahead for you because the songwriting, classic songwriting, I suppose we call it, as we've talked about earlier, was the strongest element. So for you, was Deacon Blue just the kind of vehicle for your songs?
I guess it was. But, you know, it was only afterwards you realised, you know, when you've gone through something like we went through. We're talking about, you know, coming from just playing these dead-end gigs in Glasgow, all sort of, you know, be stuck on a stage at 1 a.m. or whatever. And then you come into making a record and finally having success with it and people coming to see your gigs. When you made that journey, and together as six people we made it, that six people become far more important than these other five than you'd ever realised. And you can split it up, but we were always people, we were like kind of war veterans or something. We all went through a sort of, you know, we all went through, but it wasn't, it was the opposite. It was kind of like, there was no bloodshed and there was no nastiness. It was, we'd gone through, but we'd gone through something that only us understood. And we now still, the four of us are the core of the band. You know, there's things that we don't forget. And we went through these times together. It changed us, you know, it changed our lives in a way that we can, some, you know, I don't know, it's hard to quantify really, but it did change us. So after all that happened and we kind of got back together, we sort of took stock and thought, actually, this is okay, you know. We came away from it, I came away from 94, I think all of us were just needing a break from it.
And yeah.
We just didn't have a record to make. There wasn't an obvious record to make, and that was a dead simple decision. But it was only afterwards realised, yeah, actually, we had good things, and let's keep the good things and just leave the bad things back there.
As you mentioned, you have written with other people, you've released solo albums, you've released material with Lorraine, your wife, who was also in Deacon Blue. The people that you've written with is a really interesting list, actually. There's James Blunt, Ronan Keating, Katie Tunstall, Will Young, Jamie Cullum.
Yeah.
How does that work for you in comparison to your own stuff?
It's a different exercise. I think sometimes it works really well. It can be really great because someone will say to you, that's not good enough, we can do better than that. Or you can say, oh, that's really good, and they haven't recognised it. Or they can say to you, oh, wait a minute, what did you do? That? So all these kind of things. My worry about it at the moment is when I've done more of it than less of it, is that sometimes, especially when it becomes more than two people, it can become the lowest common denominator, not the highest. And Buddy Miller, who I was in your set, I was interviewing Buddy Miller, I was in Nashville in the spring, we were talking to Buddy Miller about it, and he was saying he doesn't like it because he feels sometimes the really wacky big idea never kind of comes up. And you know, people will sometimes say to me, going to a co-write and I'm at a label saying, oh yeah, I said, well, what are you looking for? I'm looking for a dignity, and could you write that with, you know, with them or something, or with him? If I came in with that, you wouldn't want to, you know.
Yeah.
The trouble about it is it can lead to sort of songwriting by committee, and that can be deadly. But at its best, it's really good. Probably for the last 2 years, I've just shied away from it a bit more. The last maybe 2 or 3 years, just simply because we've had our own projects on. I do it for Deacon Blue, I was co-write with people, but I've done less of the speculative songwriting just because I just began to feel I'm seeing the same things, I'm hearing the same things. I need a break from it, and maybe when I come back to it, it'll be a bit fresher.
It'd be slightly insulting, as I said earlier, right at the start, in fact, to say that Believers, the new Deacon Blue album, is a comeback album, as there has been plenty of work, plenty of material over the years. But perhaps I mean that once again the stars have aligned or something, and there's some focus on the band, some real focus on the band. It's a classic Deacon Blue sounding album without being retro. You were never going to be one of those heritage bands, were you, really? It was never going to be pure nostalgia.
No, I don't think so. I think we almost did become one, and we were on tour in the 2000s, and we just eventually thought, either we stop or we do it properly. You know, either we stop, but, you know, you cannot go out. You can do a greatest hits. Anyone can do a greatest hits tour, that's fine. You can do maybe another one. But what are you going to do after that? You're just, it's not going to get any better. You can't reinvent, put anything new into there. So you're sort of just rearranging the deck chairs, really. That can become a bit deadly. And we thought, well, either we stop or carry on. And fortunately, the band was sounding so good on stage, and there was such good energy that it meant the decision to let's do something creative was actually easier, much easier to make, good place to do it. And we kind of haven't thought about it too much, but in that short space of time, since 2010, when we started writing The Hipsters, because The Hipsters really could have been made in 2011, but we just didn't have the mechanics in place.
That was the album that came out in 2012, yeah. The Hipsters.
So really from 2010 until now, It's been a very creative process. And you know, like things like we went to play in Glastonbury in 2011, which was a really interesting experience for us. You know, people thought it was significant gigs, but that was a really that was one of the most significant gigs for me. I suddenly thought, wait a minute, there's a whole lot of people here who love this stuff, and we can do, we can play to different audiences than we thought we could. And then making a record again and hearing it on the radio again. So there was, there's been a lot of kind of interesting steps along the way. But yes, I think we just wouldn't want to do that. We get asked all the time to do a thing called, what's it called?
Is it Rewind?
Rewind or something like that. And I just think, look, no, you've sort of given up then. So we don't do it, I think, importantly, because we're not just rewinding. We want to fast forward.
You write and record in a studio at home. You also actually do some work for the BBC. You just mentioned that doing interviews recently. You're a family man. Is it hard to keep a balance for you personally? Is it difficult for Ricky Ross to be, you know, five different things?
I'm not a very disciplined person. So give me some time doing nothing, and nothing will get done.
Okay.
So I'm one of these people. I need deadlines, and I'm good. I'm quite good at getting that. I'll get up in the morning, I'll get that done. But I'm better. I'm much better when I have a sort of something to meet. And I think that I really have this weekly radio program. This is an odd day. I'm not doing, we're just putting a pre-recorded thing out tonight, but it's a little oasis for me just doing that in the middle of the week, because it's completely different focus.
And that's on BBC Scotland.
BBC Scotland, Radio Scotland, yeah. And, you know, it's a little kind of place where you go and play other people's music, and it's great. So, yeah, I enjoy all these things, and hopefully they all just creatively feed into each other. But, yeah, I like the variety.
Yeah, yeah. There's a big tour coming up for Deacon Blue in the autumn. Well, we're almost in the autumn now, but a little later in the year, there's a big tour. Is it going to be as exuberant as the Glasgow performance we were talking about earlier?
Well, I was a kind of younger man. to do touring now, we've got to be fit. And so Lorraine and I have been getting fit and running, and I need to be fitter still. So once I'm kind of out on the road at the moment, so it's you don't get a chance to kind of run. And once all that's in place, and then it becomes really creative, because I think one of the things that we've done over the years is we've done good shows, and we change the show as well. I mean, we change it from tour to tour, but we also change it from night to night. And I think it has a kind of creative energy about it that people don't necessarily know what to expect on any given night. And that's good. I like that. And it keeps all the band on their toes as well. Everyone's got to have, we've got to have a lot of material there ready to go. So that will be good. And we get excited about it. You know, I'm quite, you know, there's always different thoughts going through my head about what we're going to do and how we're going to do the show. So I think given that I just need to get a bit fitter, then, yeah, it'll be okay, it'll be exuberant.
Just thinking about what you said there, the band needing to know a lot of material so you can change the set every night. Springsteen obviously has been on tour this year, and I don't think the set has been the same.
Yeah.
They must know about 150 songs,
yeah,
this band. Incidentally, his autobiography came out a week or so ago. Have you ever thought of writing?
Not really. Lorraine read it on the way down. We were down doing things in Manchester. She read it on the way in the car on the way back. And she didn't. She skipped bits. She said, I'm not too interested in the band, early bands and stuff. But she really enjoyed it. So she was giving me highlights of the book on the way in. I brought it with me, but I haven't had a chance to read much of it. No, I don't think so. And I'm not sure that from what I've heard of the Springsteen book, I needed to know anything, really. I mean, I find it quite interesting. I've read a few. I haven't read a lot of music biographies. I mean, I love Neil Young. Have I read a biography? No. So I'm kind of happy just not knowing things. The one I really loved, just because it was such a good book, was the Dylan Chronicles.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was so creative. And you didn't need to be a Dylan fan. It was just so beautifully written. So interesting.
Possibly his last great piece of work.
It might well be, might well be. But his, you know, so I don't think so. I don't think there's anything I really need to do. I don't think I've got anything to... I don't know. I mean, unless something really changes, I don't think I've really got anything worthwhile to say in prose.
In prose. I'm glad you added that. Well, best of luck with the album. I think there's some really great moments on it, actually, including the single This Is a Love Song, which we'll play out within a moment. Ricky Ross, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
morning comes to the sound of bells lying beside me, saying you gotta be somewhere else. There was a time everything got lost, everyone and everything we once loved was in the past. Across the room, you're looking at me. You touch the handle and you're looking at me. Walking out that door, still looking at me. There's something, there's something, there's something you gotta know. Nothing gonna change anymore. I get so worried when you don't appear. I get so worried when you come too near. Standing in your way, but you're still looking at me. There's something, there's something, there's something you gotta know. Love is enough, love will do. Love lasts longer than anything you're going through. Love is enough, love will do. Love lasts longer than anything you're going through. Love song. This is a love song. Love song. This is a love song. You gotta walk a long way. Walk a long way. Walk a long way to come back again. You gotta walk a long way. Walk a long way. Walk a long way to come back again.
www.themouthmagazine.com